running a little bit ahead, but if you all would like to proceed, Ms. Bourne, as the appellant in this case, you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Rosemary Bourne on behalf of the appellant, the Commonwealth of Virginia. The question in this case involves a misdemeanor, which pursuant to 46.2-113 and Rule 3B:2 is a Class 4 misdemeanor with a $15 fine. And, of course, the issue here is whether the circuit court erred by granting a motion to suppress evidence based on a violation of statute.
Ms. Bourne, this is Judge Haley, and I had a couple of quick questions to try to narrow the issue. At page 76 of the transcript, Judge Denneke says as follows, there is absolutely no testimony that there was any interference in traffic, that there was any malicious or careless interference with the orderly passage of vehicles. Do you dispute that finding?
No, Your Honor. I think that that is a factual finding that's binding on us, and I don't believe there was any testimony.
Right. I'm looking at page 6 of your brief when you quote the statute and you say they shall cross wherever possible only at intersections or marked crosswalks. And that, I gather, is what you rely upon. Is that correct?
Well, I think that was the argument that was made below and in the assignment of error, yes, that language... the legislature could not have intended that language to be superfluous, and therefore it has to have some meaning beyond merely causing careless or malicious interference with traffic.
All right. Well, that said, the statute says wherever possible. In theory, it's possible to cross at an intersection that's marked intersection that's 3 miles away. That's certainly possible, isn't it?
I agree with that statement, yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Please proceed with your argument.
So as argued here, you know, the assignment of error that was presented in this case by the Commonwealth Attorney is that Spotsylvania Circuit Court erred in ruling that pedestrians are not required by Section 46.2-923 to cross a highway at an intersection wherever possible and granting the motions to suppress on that basis. And so the focus of their argument had to do with whether or not the statute, the court interpreted the statute erroneously. And as I previously argued, although the statute initially has the first sentence requires malicious or careless interference with the orderly passage of vehicles, the second sentence says that pedestrians shall cross wherever possible only at intersections or marked crosswalks. And the testimony
here... this is Judge Alston, we should have said something at the beginning. If counsel could take a breath every now and then, because when you're on these calls and one person's talking, another person can't hear. But I did have a question for you. You pointed out at the beginning of your argument that the violation involved is one that encompasses a $15 fine and the like, and I think everyone has recognized that the officer's main concern in the case was stopping these individuals because they had tattoos on their face and that the jaywalking was basically a pretext. I think everyone agrees with that. If this is indeed a case where we're talking about a violation of the jaywalking statute, what type of confrontation is are the officers allowed to have? It seems to me they get their names and their addresses and they give them the citation for jaywalking. Does jaywalking involve a criminal record check?
I don't know that there's any prohibition about doing a criminal records check at all. And of course, if it's a statutory violation, there is no exclusionary rule pursuant to a violation of the statute.
A Rodriguez case suggests something different, that if there's a circumstance where an individual can be confronted by the police, and let's assume for the sake of our discussion here that the individuals can be confronted by the police regarding a jaywalking violation, that doesn't extend to the investigation of other criminal activity, does it?
Well, I mean, again, I'm not sure now whether or not a full-fledged search or something like that, you know, I certainly understand, I take Your Honor's point, but as far as a criminal records check, you know, I would say that that is not an overly intrusive measure to be taken when stopping someone to issue a citation.
And in this case, do you agree that the officers actually never saw the individuals cross the street? As I read the record in this matter, one of the officers saw that one of the appellees put their foot down on the street as if to cross the street, and then they went up about a tenth of a mile, turned around, and that they were on the other side of the street, so obviously they crossed. But the bottom line is the officers never actually observed the individuals jaywalking, did they?
Well, I mean, I think that the court made a factual finding that they crossed the street, and that was not the issue that was, you know, argued below or really at issue below. Of course, they saw them walking out and then immediately saw them being across the street. So, although I certainly think that gives rise to observing them enough for them to say that they observed them cross the street.
Follow up a little bit on Judge Haley's question, and it was an excellent question. In this case, the officers, or the testimony in the case, was that the intersection, which would have been the preferred method of crossing, was about a tenth of a mile down the road. So a tenth of a mile is 176 yards, based upon what I learned in elementary school. So theoretically, the people would have had to go up the street 176 yards, cross the street there, and then come back down the street another 176 yards to get to where they were trying to get. In other words, walk a third of a mile to cross the street. Is that what the statute envisions, or does the statute envision that people cross the street where it's not to endanger themselves or other vehicles or to cross at places that are safe?
Well, I mean, I think that the legislature intends what it says, and there is no point in having the second section of sentence in that statute if you actually have to have proof that you maliciously interfere or carelessly interfere with the passage of traffic. So because that sentence is there, I mean, the legislature is saying you can't cross outside, I mean, a crosswalk, unless it's,
Warren,
I mean, if it's Warren, possible, yes.
This is Judge Beals. I would like to follow up on that, too, because, as you say, there are three sentences here that we're looking at. Even if there is no evidence of carelessly interfering with the orderly passage of vehicles, because I gather there's no evidence put forward about whether any vehicles on the road at that time other than the police vehicle that's already passed, right?
That's correct.
So you focus on the second sentence, but the second sentence is followed by the third, which says, where intersections contain no marked crosswalks and the one a tenth of a mile away did not contain a crosswalk, pedestrians shall not be guilty of negligence as a matter of law for crossing at any such intersection or between intersections when crossing by the most direct route. Isn't that what happened here? They crossed between them, but they crossed straight across, as best we know?
Well, Your Honor, I take your point. I will say that interpreting the statute, I have two responses. So the first is, I believe that third sentence is aimed at what the civil cases talk about, which is we're not going to say as a matter of law that you can't, you know, recover damages or you're going to be civilly liable if you use the most direct route, because if it in fact means what I believe Your Honor is arguing or says that it means, that also negates the second sentence. So in essence, there's no point in having any part other than the first sentence of the statute, which is not what the legislature could have possibly meant.
That's not what the question I have, though. My question is, even if, as you say, you don't have to prove the first sentence, carelessly or maliciously, and no one's arguing here that it's malicious, and there's no evidence of traffic on the road, so it's hard to understand how it can be proved that it's careless. So even if you look at just the rest of this part of the statute, sentences 2 and 3, the second sentence talks about crossing where possible at intersections or march crosswalks. But then it says where intersections contain no march crosswalks, which this one did not have, the one a tenth of a mile away, as I understand it. And correct me if I'm wrong about that.
No, there was no testimony about any crosswalk.
So if it's not even negligent to then cross in the most direct route between intersections, which is what happened here apparently, why are they violating this in a way that leads to reasonable articulable suspicion that a misdemeanor has occurred if it's not even negligent to do it then?
Well, I mean, certainly the reasonable articulable suspicion is a much lower standard. I mean, we can get it, and there is some, I think, legitimate question about the assignment of error and what was actually preserved here by that assignment of error. But nonetheless, I would certainly argue that there was reasonable suspicion to stop them based on what they saw. And, of course, even we know that officers can make mistakes of law, and that doesn't necessarily obviate a reasonable suspicion.
Well, I mean, you do cite the Hyen versus North Carolina case, but that wasn't argued below, was it?
Well, what was argued was that there was, and I do think it was fairly argued, that there was a reasonable suspicion to stop them. But no, I don't think that specific case was cited. I would concede that.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to take you off your argument, but...
Well, I think I've made the argument that was presented to the degree that, I mean, I can make it. I'm not sure that I would disagree with Your Honor about the import of the third section of the statute, because obviously the second section has to have meaning. Sentence has to have some meaning. And what the court actually ruled in this case was that, and erroneously ruled, was that there had to be malicious or careless interference with the passage of vehicles. That was the ruling, that you had to have both that and, I guess, failure to cross at a crosswalk. But that's not what the statute says.
We're not necessarily bound by what the trial court said as far as that's concerned, because we're making a Fourth Amendment inquiry. We could, if we thought it was appropriate in this case, make a right result, wrong reason determination, correct?
If all the facts were necessary were presented, yes, Your Honor. I mean, I do think that the only, I suppose, issue that was appealed was the statutory interpretation issue. But
Ms. Warren, I think at page 77, the court said, but simply crossing not at an intersection is not a violation of the law. So didn't the court articulate, it didn't just say that reckless and careless interference. Isn't that correct?
Well, I think my reading of his statements was that there also had to be that you had to show interference with the orderly passage of vehicles, and that statement was just amplifying what he had previously said.
Thank you.
Not with regard to the third sentence of the statute.
All right.
And if the court doesn't have any further questions for me, I would just ask that you reverse.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Bourne. You actually have about 2 minutes left should you need it.
Thank you.
All right. We have, just on the docket, I have Mr. Reyes listed first, then Mr. Barbaro. Is that how you'd like to proceed, or I leave that up to you, counsel?
That's fine.
That's fine with me as well.
All right. Mr. Reyes, you may proceed.
Thank you. May I please escort Christopher Reyes on behalf of Mr. Donald? I think in this case, the issue that was appealed by the Commonwealth is simply, as stated, did the court make a ruling saying that you don't have to cross at a crosswalk? And interpreting the statute, it's clear that you don't have to cross at a crosswalk. The second sentence is the one that I think is persuasive here, and it says you have to cross wherever possible. And I think that's what the issue comes down to, is you don't have to cross at a crosswalk if it's not possible, or if there is no crosswalk, you can cross in between intersections. That's clearly what the legislature intended when they amended this statute. Looking at what the court asked of the Commonwealth at the Joint Appendix, page 67, I believe, she clearly said there was no crosswalk here. Isn't that the situation we have? So we have to go to this third sentence that says you can cross in between intersections when it is not possible and there is no crosswalk at that intersection. The court was very familiar with this intersection. It is a drive she makes regularly. And looking at the pictures that were submitted into evidence, you can see that this intersection contained over 20 lanes of traffic. And that's the intersection that the Commonwealth is saying it's possible for them to have crossed at. I don't think it's logical to make the conclusion that these two men could have possibly crossed at that crosswalk. I think the court, in her ruling, although she didn't articulate that it was not possible to cross there, I think that viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the appellees, as you have to, it's clear that that finding was made by the court, that there was no way that they could have crossed there. It was not possible to cross that mine road. And what they did was not a violation of the law.
Counsel, aren't we mixing apples and oranges here, though? If you go down that road, I don't think it necessarily helps your argument, because it has been recognized under the case law that the officer can have a mistaken view of what the law is, which then gets us to the problem that we have. So does focusing on whether or not this is a violation of the law or not really help you?
Absolutely, because I don't think that issue was preserved for appeal. And any argument about a mistake of law was abandoned by the Commonwealth in their notice or in their
issue. So you think this case should be by way of procedural default?
I think so. I think that the assignment of error that the Commonwealth made was only that the judge erred in finding that the statute does not require you to cross at a crosswalk. That is the only thing that the Commonwealth pointed out in their assignment of error, and it's the only thing that was argued in the petition for appeal that was granted. We can't go back now and resurrect an argument made at the trial court, even though it was made, when it was abandoned on this appeal. So the only issue is, did the court err in determining or interpreting the statute? I don't think that any argument has been made that clearly shows that. The court knew that. Yep.
This is Judge Haley. I wanted to. The statute says wherever possible. And I would tend to read that as wherever reasonably possible. As Judge Austin pointed out, the closest intersection was 1/10 of a mile away. But if it were 10 miles away, it would certainly be possible, if you wanted to walk 10 miles, to cross there. What do you think of that reading of whenever reasonably possible? Hello?
I think that is a fair interpretation, but that would be a factual issue that the judge would have had to make a factual finding, and we have to stand by her factual finding. She, in questioning the Commonwealth, specifically said, we have to go to that next sentence because there was no crosswalk there.
Let me get you to switch gears just a little bit in your time, because I know you're splitting your time. You heard me ask Ms. Bourne a question about the nature of the encounter. What would be your position with regard to the nature of the encounter? And let's assume for the sake of discussion, that the initial confrontation over the jaywalking was appropriate. Let's assume that. What more can the officers do at that point?
I think at that point it would have only been reasonable to detain them long enough to get their name and then issue the citation. It is a Class 4 misdemeanor, and that's it. There was no need to run any sort of criminal background check. The officers didn't have any other reasonable suspicion other than just a jaywalking. And so I think that the most that they could have or should have done is gotten their names merely to write down the ticket without detaining them any longer in order to run any sort of background check on them. So I don't think it was appropriate for them to detain them longer based just on the jaywalking statute.
So are you arguing that the officers often stop cars for a taillight being out, that in the process of calling in their stop, and when they get the ID or license, that they can't run that name to make sure that there's no arrest warrant out for it, for example, for that individual?
Wouldn't it really, counsel, depend on the nature of the encounter?
I agree. I think it would depend on the nature of the encounter, and I think it would be a different situation when someone is in a car, which is highly mobile. And so I think there'd be a distinction there in that these people were on foot.
Thank you.
Yes. So if you have any further questions, I would defer the rest of the time to Mr. Barbara.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Reyes. Mr. Barbara?
Yes, sir. Thank you. May it please the court, Timothy Barbaro, on behalf of Delicio Sampaio. I would ask the court to uphold the trial court's ruling to suppress the evidence. I'd like to point out a couple things. Number one, with regard to the issue of whether or not this was a violation of the statute or not, I cited the case of Shutt v. Brockwell, Supreme Court case 214 Virginia 38, 1973, and it dealt with the Virginia Code 46.1230A, which was the predecessor to the statute at question here. And it's sort of remarkable. It's on all fours with the facts of this case, in the sense that the gentleman crosses, he crosses six lanes of traffic, goes over to a gas station, he goes directly across, then comes back across and is struck by a vehicle. Now, it's a civil case, but, you know, the argument raised by the defense in that particular case was that his crossing between intersections violated the statute. And the Supreme Court held, and I'll quote, "We do not agree with defendant's contention. The photographs introduced as exhibits show that there was no marked crosswalks for pedestrians. Thus, plaintiff's act of crossing between intersections did not violate the statute and constitute negligence as a matter of law." So it even though it's a civil case, I mean, they address it and they say that his crossing of the between intersections did not violate statute. And the intersection at question in this particular case was a mere 100 feet down the road from where the gentleman crossed the road. And so I think that the law has been, I'm sorry.
Counsel, does contributory negligence assessment, and that's what that Shutt case was talking about, the defendants were trying to show that there's contributory negligence on the part of the plaintiff, thereby preventing him from being able to recover civilly. And I think that that's part of the reason why the statute was written this way. But in any event, does that kind of analysis necessarily transpose to Fourth Amendment jurisprudence?
Well, I mean, if there is no, the contributory negligence was supposedly arose out of his violation of the statute, and they were arguing that he was contributory negligent as a matter of law because he had violated the statute. What I'm saying is that when the Supreme Court addressed this, they said that his crossing did not violate the statute. And so I think it does relate to the issues here, because the court has held that essentially the same type of conduct that Sampaio and Donald were engaged in did not violate the statute. And if it does not violate the statute, then I don't believe that, and that's essentially what the trial court held here, that their conduct did not violate statute and therefore cannot provide the basis for a stop under the Fourth Amendment.
But
Judge Haley, how are you?
Good, Judge Haley.
I gather your argument is if they weren't negligent based on your civil case, how can they be criminal? The same act.
Well, I agree. I mean, if they were not negligent, then they could not be criminal. And again, I think that's exactly what the Supreme Court held in Schutt v. Brockwell, and that's also exactly what Judge Denneke held in this particular case. In this particular case, these two gentlemen crossed the highway. There was no traffic. There's no evidence that there was even any traffic on the highway other than the deputy's vehicle, which had already passed these two gentlemen. So there's no. I'm sorry.
The Commonwealth has conceded that they're not relying on that, you know, interference with traffic argument.
Yes, and they're essentially relying on the, again, we get into the second sentence, which talks about wherever possible they shall cross at intersections or marked crosswalks, and of course there are no marked crosswalks here. And again, we go to Judge Field's issue again. The third sentence, which talks about though that they shall not be, and where intersections contain no marked crosswalks, which is the case here, they shall not be guilty of negligence as a matter of law for crossing at any such intersection or between intersections. And I think Judge Denneke did. You know, in her opinion, she did reference that she made a finding herself that there were no crosswalks at the intersection. And she also, as Judge Haley pointed out, she said not only did she say they did not maliciously or carelessly interfere with traffic, but she also said simply not crossing at an intersection is not a violation of the law. And so therefore, she did not believe it was reasonable for these two officers to stop these two individuals.
Barbara, let me follow up a little bit on Judge Haley's question. In the Hine case, which has been referenced, even though it might not have been referenced at the level, Supreme Court of the United States held that reasonable mistakes of law, like those of fact, would justify certificates of probable cause. And let's assume, for the sake of our discussion again, that Judge Denneke got it right, that what the defendants engaged in was not a violation of the law. But if the officers had a reasonable mistake of law, in other words, they interpreted the statute incorrectly, would they still not, in some circumstances, not necessarily be justified in the confrontation that occurred here?
Well, I think that if you look at the statute and you can look at their conduct, and there is no possible way that you can look at that conduct and say that conduct constitutes a violation of the statute, that there is no way when a court looks at this that you can then say that an officer can have a good faith mistaken belief. I mean, there has to be
a judge's determination was that the officer's view of the law was not reasonable. That would have to be your argument.
Yes, I don't see how their view of it could be reasonable. I mean, first of all, there was no real evidence adduced at the hearing about what their view of the statute was. You know, there wasn't this discussion, there wasn't this testimony from the deputies that we thought that they had to go down and cross at the crosswalk. Wasn't any of that. That was an argument made by the Commonwealth attorney to try to justify and support stop. There wasn't testimony that was elicited from the officers or even proffered that they...
What about the evidence that there was a crest in the hill that obscured pedestrians from the vision of approaching drivers? When you look at the pictures, it's hard to see that unless perhaps it's from people going north, which is, if you look in the pictures, it appears to be maybe a small crest there, and the officers say they lost sight of them as they were going south, looking back north.
Yes. I mean, there was testimony about that, and I agree, having, you know, been familiar, and of course the trial court was very familiar with this stretch of road as well, that, you know, the where they crossed was a fair distance past where that crest was. It was no, fellow counsel's argument about going down. I mean, the Commonwealth's argument is that these two gentlemen should have gone further north and crossed at a very dangerous intersection, and the court can look, you know, we submitted pictures of that intersection as part of this appeal, and look at that intersection, and to suggest that they should have gone down there, where there is, I think, 20 lanes of travel intersect there, and to cross there where there's no crosswalk, as opposed to just simply going by the most direct route possible, with as we have to take it, no traffic, is almost absurd.
Thank
I also would like to would argue that the Commonwealth failed to preserve any issue for appeal because they didn't, you know, when the trial court made its ruling, that there was no exception noted to the trial court's ruling. There was no basis for any for objection to the trial court's ruling. All that was said was that when it was when we were talking about what was going to happen next, because there was a jury trial scheduled for 2 or 3 days away, the Commonwealth said, well, we're going to appeal this decision. Now, whether or not that constitutes the type of objection that's necessary to preserve an issue for appeal, I would say that it does not, and that the Commonwealth hasn't properly preserved any issue for appeal by failing to pursuant to Rule 5A18 to preserve this any issue for appeal.
Mr. Barber, I've actually let you go over a little bit, but we've had a number of questions for you and Mr. Reyes. Would you like to wrap up quickly?
No, I think that pretty much states my position. I appreciate the court hearing us out this morning, and I'd ask that you uphold Judge Denneke's decision. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Barber. Thank you, Mr. Reyes. You have
Thank you, Your Honor.
My calculations, 2 minutes for rebuttal if you would like to use it, Ms. Bourne.
Well, I, very, very briefly, because I don't want to belabor points that don't need to be belabored. But, I mean, first of all, I take issue with the fact that some of the sort of magic words about making exceptions to the court's ruling are necessary to preserve arguments on appeal. You know, what was said here, the Commonwealth's attorney made his arguments below during his response to the motion to suppress, and he advised the court he was planning to appeal, and that is sufficient to preserve his arguments that he made on appeal. In addition, I would just note that the Commonwealth's attorney in his petition for appeal in a footnote did cite the Hine case, so it was in the petition for appeal, and the assignment of error does reference the court's appeal, I mean the court's motion to suppress and the court ruling in granting the motion to suppress, and I think those things in tandem are arguably could be give reasonable certainty to preserve those issues. And then I would just note that with regard to the crest in the roadway and that issue, I mean, there was a proffer of facts below that was not objected to. And the proffer of facts, I think, said that there was a crest in the roadway that made it difficult for pedestrians to be seen by northbound traffic, and that there had been a number of traffic incidents there were pedestrians attempting to cross the street or struck by vehicles. So that information was certainly before the court, not necessarily maybe relevant to what the statutory interpretation argument, but certainly I think on some of these other issues that have been raised. With that, those small things, I would just ask the court to reverse.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Bourne. We appreciate your argument. Mr. Reyes, Mr. Barber, we appreciate your argument. The court will now go into conference, and we will be back with you before too long with their decision.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank
you. You too.